Of course, we're in John chapter 18, beginning in verse 12 here. Tonight we're just going to look at what I would say probably we could call his religious trials. We talked just briefly last week, we just mentioned that there are actually six different trials that Jesus has. And that's very important for us to understand the significance of that. A lot of times, some of the things, for example, like the prophecies, that he would be dumb before his accusers, like a sheep before the shearers, that he wasn't going to speak. And yet, then we read, as we will some tonight, that he's asked questions and he answers those questions and he speaks. And we're like, wait a minute. I thought he wasn't going to speak before his accusers. And the fact of the matter is that because of the fact that he had six different trials, it didn't mean that he wasn't going to ever speak any at all during any of that process, but we will run across the one in which he did not speak. And he was dumb meaning not speaking, as the King James uses it, not dumb as in stupid, but he did not speak throughout the entire trial before Herod, who was the king of the Jews at that time, who was the one who actually technically would have been the one who was in authority. It's kind of an odd situation that we have. We have the high priests who think they're in charge. We have the Sanhedrin council of Pharisees and Sadducees and so forth, and they think they're in charge. You've got King Herod who thinks he's in charge. You've got Pilate who thinks he's in charge. Of course, the fact of the matter is God was in charge of the whole thing. But throughout this, who actually would have been the one who had the authority under the law of Moses? Well, there's some debate on that too, because some would say, well, the high priest certainly had certain authority. Well, the high priest wasn't the judge, though. The high priest certainly did some things. He decided some things. There were a lot of things the high priest did. But when it came to judging things, if we look throughout the Old Testament, primarily it was the king. Now, of course, before the time of the kings, things were a little different. You had judges, and you had Moses during the time he was alive, and then Joshua after him. And then you had this series of different ones that decided these things. And you had judges throughout the land who made decisions. But you didn't have one central figure that was the authority until Saul became king. And Samuel was rejected. God says he was rejected. The people have chosen. They want to have a king to rule over them. And from that time on, the only one that we read about throughout the rest of the Old Testament who has authority in matters of life and death is the king. And so, technically, that would be King Herod. Although, I don't know if you remember, we've studied a little about King Herod in the past. King Herod wasn't even a Jew. He wasn't even an Israelite, which was kind of disturbing. He was an Edomite. He was of the descendants of Esau. How that must have irked the Jewish people to be being ruled by someone who was a descendant of Esau and not a descendant of Jacob. And so there was a lot of, we talked about this morning, the turmoil that was going on in that. We talked about that in class this morning when we were talking about Pilate and his question, "What shall I do with Jesus?" But as we look into this situation, we realize that there was a dispersion, I guess you could say, of authority and power that kind of throws us for a loop sometimes, trying to figure out, well, who's who and what's what. And so what we discussed just briefly, we just mentioned last week, and we will come back to it again in future weeks as well. But what we discussed was, first he goes before Annas, then he goes before Caiaphas, then he also goes before the entire Sanhedrin council. Then he goes before Pilate. Then Pilate sends him to Herod. And then Herod sends him back to Pilate. So six different cases where he's being charged and accused and tried, if you will, in these different monkey courts, really. Because other than Pilate, none of them really had much authority as far as the Roman government was concerned. So it's an interesting thing. You've got, well, what did the law of Moses say? What did God say was supposed to be the authority? Then you've got, well, the people rejected God's law and they set themselves up a king, so he's the authority. And he said, no, God punished them and sent the Romans to take over the land, and so they're in charge. But as Jesus told Pilate, when Pilate said, don't you know I've got the authority here? He said, you would have no authority if it weren't given to you from above. And now he wasn't talking about Caesar. He was talking about God instituting governments among men. And that ultimately, all of the rulers, whether it was the priests, the Sanhedrin, the king, or the governor, they all had to answer to God, ultimately, for the way that they behaved in this series of fiascos in finding an innocent man guilty and condemning him to death. Well, we saw, and of course last week we took a little detour into the denials of Peter, Peter denying Christ. And so back to the garden then, if we go back at the end of chapter, of verse 11 of chapter 18, we saw there that you know, they had come to arrest Jesus. So in verse 12, the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Now, it's my, to the best of my understanding, and I am, my Greek teacher's here tonight, so he can testify that I'm not a Greek scholar. Okay, so I have to take other people's word for it when people tell me what a Greek word means. And so I may or may not be right about it. I have to trust some other folks on the meanings of various Greek words. But the understanding that I have of it is that the term here, which is referred to as the captain in the English translations, this captain, the Greek word there was actually the word that indicated a captain over 1,000. Not a centurion, which is a captain over 100, but actually, I believe the word, I couldn't even begin to pronounce it, but something to the effect of a chiliarch or kiliarch, something to that effect. And so this is the person then that would be over, he'd have 10 centurions under him. This was a high-ranking officer, militarily speaking. And so you see the importance that the Jewish leaders placed on capturing Jesus. Now, this doesn't mean that there were 1,000 soldiers that came out to the garden to arrest Jesus. But they had that officer. Now, this is like, just because you have a general present, it doesn't mean that all of the soldiers under him are going to be there with him. But you've got the authority of that general. And so they went to get Jesus. They didn't just grab a couple of soldiers and say, hey, come on, let's go arrest him. It'd be kind of like with the police today. They didn't just get a couple of officers or even a couple of detectives. They didn't even get the chief of police. They went all the way up to the top rank to get the highest ranking officer they could to be there for this arrest. They wanted the big guy to be there. And so he was. And of course they had a band of soldiers. We don't know exactly how many was in a band, but certainly there would have been enough soldiers that they would have been prepared for any eventuality. Of course, if they had known who Jesus was and really understood anything about what he had taught throughout his life, they would have known they didn't need a whole group of soldiers, and they would have known as well that if he didn't want to be arrested by them, they wouldn't be able to take him even if they did have that 1,000 soldiers. It wouldn't have mattered. He went with them because he chose to, and we saw that a couple of weeks ago when they came before him, and he said, who are you seeking? And they said, Jesus. And he said, I am he. They all fall back down on the ground. But then he lets them take him. He didn't have to do that. He could have fought without the aid of Peter and his sword lopping off a guy's ear. He didn't need that. He could have done it with just one word to his heavenly Father, and he would have sent thousands upon thousands of angels. But they did bind him. We notice that they're coming after an innocent man who, at that moment, his only cry, you know, did he resist arrest? Is that why they cuffed him and threw him in the back of the police car, so to speak? No. All he did was heal the man whose ear had been cut off. What a horrible guy this is. Well, we better bind him because he might escape. And of course we know the bindings were meaningless anyway. If he had chosen to escape them, he easily could have. They had no power over him. As we talked about this morning, Jesus said that he was laying down his life so that he could take it up again. He didn't just get overpowered by the Jews or by the Romans. It wasn't the case. He laid it down. He gave up his life. In verse 13 then, after they've arrested him, the first thing they do is they lead him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. That's an interesting term there. He was the high priest that year, which is very odd because if you read back in the Law of Moses, you'll find that the high priesthood was a position of authority that was held throughout your lifetime. You didn't have it for a year. It wasn't an elected position where you served for a year or 4 years or something like that. It wasn't like the president, like we're going to elect this fall. It wasn't like that at all. Once you became the high priest, you remained the high priest until either your death or the age of your retirement, which generally the priesthood had to quit serving at age 60, although some debated whether the high priest had to stop at 60 or not, but the average priest stopped at age 60 and retired. But Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Annas had actually been the high priest. Annas had actually commanded, according to historical references outside of the scriptures, he had actually, in 14 AD, supposedly, he'd killed someone who broke the Sabbath, which was lawful according to the Law of Moses, but the Romans didn't like it, so they kicked him out of the priesthood. This goes back again, and you know, some of this we discussed in class this morning, so some of you who weren't in our Sunday morning class, you may miss a few things there. One of the things that was discussed in them taking him to Pilate was that, well, we don't have the authority to put people to death. That was as a result of this situation in 14 AD where Annas actually had someone executed for breaking the Law of Moses, and so they stripped him of his power and said, you can't be the high priest anymore. Tiberius was the emperor at that time, and he stripped him and said, you can't be the high priest anymore. So it got passed around to several members of his family, and Caiaphas was just one of those family members that got to take his turn being the high priest. And you see how corrupt the whole system of the priesthood had become by this time. The high priest was supposed to be based on descendancy from Aaron. Aaron was the first high priest, and then it was to go to his son and his son after him and so forth. And that, yet by this time we have a situation where basically the person who got to be the high priest got to be the high priest because they bought the office. They bribed their way into getting to be the high priest. And you say, well, why? Who would want to be the high priest anyway? Well, aside from the authority and power, there was also great wealth associated with it. Just like with a lot of our political offices today, there's often great wealth that comes from getting involved with these things. In the case of the high priest, there were several of the sacrifices and offerings that when they were given, a certain portion went to the priest who made the offering or sacrifice, and another portion went to the high priest. And so he got lots of wealth as a result of this. And if these folks at this time were as crooked as Samuel and Eli's sons were, they were probably cheating the people in addition to that to get even more wealth. They were charging, you know, the temple tax, and they were probably skimming off the top of that. They were probably taking some of the animals that were supposed to be sacrificed and keeping them for themselves and offering a blemished one that they weren't supposed to be doing. We see Jesus condemning them a great deal for a lot of the corruption and the horrible things that they're doing. He's upset at them for selling the animals in the temple and making it a marketplace and various different things. But there are all sorts of accusations of the corruption that was going on by this time. And yet, that's who they take him to first, is this Annas, who, according to the Romans, has no authority at this time. He's been deposed now for about 20 years. He didn't have any authority, but the Jewish people still, at least the leadership of the Jewish people, still look up to him as the main guy. And so they go to him first. And he's going to ask Jesus some questions, and then when he gets done, then he's going to send him on to Caiaphas. So it was Caiaphas, as you remember. Now, Caiaphas was actually acting as high priest. And it was Caiaphas who, back in John chapter 11, had warned the people of the danger of Jesus. Remember, he said, wait a minute, here, don't you know anything? Don't you realize how important, in John chapter 11, verses 49 and 50, don't you realize how expedient it is that one man should die for the people and not the whole nation suffer? Because they were concerned at that time that the Roman government was going to come and take their power away from them because of Jesus. And he said, don't you realize how good it'd be if this one guy died instead of us all suffering? Well, now that one guy, Jesus, is about to die. And so you see what an impartial and unbiased judge these Annas and Caiaphas are going to be to Jesus, right? He's going to get a fair trial, surely, from these two guys, isn't he? Well, not at all. In fact, there is nothing remotely fair about this trial at all. We certainly don't have time, even in several lessons, to really cover all the ins and outs of all of the trials of Jesus. People have written entire books about the trials of Jesus and the events that took place surrounding them. But here we see these two corrupt officials, dirty, rotten scoundrels, and they're going to be judging someone who's sinless and perfect. How ironic that these two individuals, as corrupt as they are going to be placing judgment on the only perfect one who's ever lived. Just doesn't seem right, does it? And yet this is all part of God's plan to bring salvation for us. We're going to skip now because we looked at the situation there with Peter in between there. So they brought him in, and Peter's out in the courtyard, and they're discussing out there, but he's in here, and John's come in because John knows the high priest's family. He's got some connections there with his family and their family. And so then we come to verse 19. And John says, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples. Now remember, they haven't taken him to the actual high priest, Caiaphas, yet. They've taken him to Annas, who's not really technically the high priest. But again, John's usage of the term high priest here to refer to Annas indicates one of two things. One, it could be like we continue to call the president's president even after they're not president anymore. You know, we talk about President Clinton and President Bush and the other President Bush and President Carter. You know, they're not president anymore, but they still hold that title. So it's possible that's what John's doing with the high priest title, that Annas is still high priest even though he's not technically still high priest. He still gets that title. Or it's possible that John is pointing out to us the fact that as far as the Jews were concerned, the Romans didn't have any authority to be messing in their affairs and telling them who could and couldn't be the high priest. And so to the many of the Jews, it may very well have been that Annas was still considered to be the high priest. And that could be the indication that John gives us here as well. But he began to question Jesus about his disciples and his teachings. Now, this guy's not very well informed, or is he? He's really just kind of doing what some lawyers would refer to as a fishing expedition. He's just trying to get Jesus to say something that they can then use against him. Now, in America, we have the Miranda rights where they say anything you say can and be used against you in the court of law, and you know it's time to shut up and get your lawyer, right? But they didn't have that back then. And so Jesus, of course, did know what to say and what not to say. It wasn't an issue. But here Annas is questioning him and saying, hey, okay, you know, tell me this, tell me that. We don't have recorded exactly what questions he's asking about the teachings, but we can tell a little something from Jesus' answer. In verse 20, Jesus answered him, "I've spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temples where all the Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret." Now, again, one of the things that we've looked at and talked about throughout the Gospel of John is how people like to twist things to try to make contradictions in the Bible. Jesus on one occasion tells the disciples, "What I've told you in secret, you shout it from the rooftops." Well, wait a minute. Now he's saying, "I've said nothing in secret." Which is it? Well, the fact of the matter is that what he's saying is nothing that he said in secret was anything that he had not also been taught publicly. These are the same teachings have been done there. It doesn't mean that he never talked to his disciples privately. You know, that the only time he ever talked to the 12 was when they were in the temple surrounded by everybody else. Well, no, we know that's not the case. We know that sometimes they asked him questions about the parables and he explained them to them and everybody else didn't get the explanation. But he wasn't being secretive and furtive and trying to conspire against the Jewish leaders with any of that kind of thing. But he says, "Hey, I've been teaching openly. I've been telling you what I believe and what you're right about and what you're wrong about." And he's, "I've been in the temple talking with all the people. Why didn't you arrest me? If I was doing something wrong, if I was saying something wrong, how come you never arrested me during those times?" We see what a hypocrite Annas is. Here he is. He is going to question Jesus about these things that involve secrets and being secretive and not, and you know, corruption and that kind of an idea. You're going to question Jesus about that? You're the one who in secret conspired to go arrest an innocent man. You're going to question him about his conspiracies. That's often the way that works. You know, I found it's often the case that someone who is guilty of a particular crime is very suspicious of everyone else and thinking that they are guilty of that crime. I've seen it time and time again. The mate that's cheating on their spouse is constantly jealous and accusing the other one of being the one that's cheating when it's really them. The thief is always thinking that everybody else is trying to steal from them. You know, these are the kinds of things that people do. It's the way people are. And that's the way Annas was. He knew he had secretly conspired all these things, and so he wants to accuse Jesus of doing this kind of thing as well. Then in verse 21, so Jesus says, "Why are you asking me? Ask those who have heard me what I said. They know what I said. You go ask me. You go get some witnesses. Let's bring the witnesses in here." Now they will bring in some witnesses. They're going to try to get some witnesses. Of course, most of the witnesses they got were just as corrupt and crooked as they are. But they're going to try. What's more, even the Sanhedrin council and even the chief priests and the Pharisees had sent people to listen in to Jesus. In fact, on one occasion they sent people to arrest him and they came back empty-handed. Do you remember that? We talked about that a few weeks back. And they came back empty-handed and they said, "Well, why didn't you arrest him?" And they said, "Nobody ever spoke like this guy." So, yeah, you want to know what I said? Ask those guys. They came to arrest me and they came back away empty-handed. They knew I wasn't saying anything wrong. So throughout, he points them, "Hey, the mass of humanity in Jerusalem would have gladly told, 'Hey, here's what I heard Jesus say.' The problem was that all of the things they heard Jesus say in context would never have convicted him of any crime. So what they finally wind up having to do, of course, is what they're going to do is they're going to take something out of context. We're not going to get that far tonight because we're really just going to look at Annas and Caiaphas here a little bit tonight. But then in front of the whole Sanhedrin, more things happen. And we're probably not even going to finish Caiaphas tonight. In verse 22 then, when he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" It's interesting, this is a similar scenario to one that Paul was involved in, where Paul said something back to the high priest and he got struck for it as well. But Jesus' response is a little different than Paul's. Paul actually apologizes for it. Jesus doesn't apologize. They say, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" Well, Jesus says, "Yeah, you betcha." Jesus said, "If what I said is wrong, then prove it. You bear witness to the fact that I'm lying, that I'm saying something wrong. But if what I said is right, what are you hitting me for? Why are you hitting somebody because they're saying what's right?" You know, another thing, don't kill the messenger. Jesus said, "Why are you hitting me? If I said something wrong, then what did I say wrong? You bring some witnesses, you bring some proof, you show me what I did that was wrong. But if I hadn't done anything wrong, why are you hitting me for it?" So Annas gives up. He calls it quits. He realizes probably at this point he's not going to get anything out of Jesus. Although that's really... They don't really expect to. They don't really care. Do you think Annas really cares? When he's asking all these questions, "What did you teach? You know, what about your disciples?" and this, that, do you think he really cares? No, he doesn't really care what Jesus taught. He has no interest in Jesus' teaching. If he had interest in Jesus' teaching, instead of arresting him, he would have gone to listen to him teach. But he didn't do that. He sent some spies who came back and reported the things that Jesus had taught, so he knew very well what Jesus had taught. He's just a troublemaker. He's just drunk on his own power and wanting to make an example of Jesus. And so that's what he's going to do. And then, of course, John tells us, Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So earlier we see John talking about Annas as though he's the high priest, but now we see Caiaphas is mentioned, he's the high priest. So the little bit of confusion there for some people. Oh, that's a contradiction. You know, John calls them both the high priest. And again, we explained that already, just like we might talk about, you know, President Bush and President Obama. Well, one is president right now. One was president, but we still give them the title. And that's a possibility of what was happening here as well. But when we think about this situation, we realize, of course, again, that and he's still bound. He's still handcuffed. You know, you watch trials sometimes. You know, if you go to court for a traffic ticket, they don't have you in cuffs, you know. You recognize the severity of what they're trying to do to Jesus here based on the fact that they have him bound. They're treating him like a hardened criminal. They're treating him like they would treat a murderer. Now, you go to court and there's a murderer on trial, yeah, he's going to be cuffed. And he's going to be saying, well, actually, even that. You know, even in our courts today, I sat in court where there was a murderer on trial. He wasn't in cuffs. He was just sitting there next to his lawyer. So even that, sometimes we don't put them in cuffs. We don't bind them, even if it's somebody who's on trial for murder. And yet they kept Jesus bound, and then he sends him on to the next one, still bound. Now it's interesting, Annas is only mentioned four times in the New Testament. Two of those times right here in John chapter 18. The other times are once in the beginning of Luke. And I've forgotten where the other one is at this point. But anyway, they're all in the Acts. There's one in Acts. So three in the Gospels and then one in Acts. That's why it was throwing me off. I was trying to remember which of the other Gospels mentioned him. It wasn't. It was Acts. So once in Acts, once in the beginning of Luke that just talks about John the Baptist, and it's just setting the time frame. It says it was during the time that Annas and Caiaphas were high priests. So that's given us a time frame as to when John the Baptist, John the Immerser, when he began his ministry out in the wilderness. and then the other, of course, over into Acts. So this is the most that we know about Annas, is what we read right here, from the Bible anyway. And of course, like I said, there are some historical references to him. Well, we talked in the class this morning, and I want to bring it out for all of us tonight. In class this morning, we talked about that question, what will you do with Jesus? And we talked a little bit about Jesus asking, you know, who do men say that I am? And they give him the answers, and he says, but who do you say that I am? Jesus isn't still standing in Pilate's hall. He's not standing before Annas or Caiaphas or King Herod or the Sanhedrin or any of them. But each and every day, in our minds and in our lives, Jesus is on trial of a sort. And the question comes to each of us, who do you say that I am? And what will you do with Jesus who's called Christ? What are you going to do? Each day, we have to answer that question, what will I do with Jesus today? Am I going to hold on to Him as my Savior and follow Him as my King, bow before Him as my Lord and serve Him as my Master? Or am I going to reject Him today? The fact of the matter is, probably none of us have been 100% consistent in always choosing the right thing to do with Jesus each day. But Jesus is still faithful. He still loves us. He's willing to forgive, as we saw this morning from the sayings on the cross. He's willing to forgive us, wanting to welcome us back, wanting us still, just like Peter, even after he had denied Him, Jesus didn't throw him off. He still wanted him to be part of his family. And he wants us to be part of his family today. But we need to strive to put him first. We need to decide that what I'm going to do with Jesus is not treat him the way that these folks did. I'm not going to bind him up and send him captive away from me. You see, if Annas had really, really cared about what Jesus said, what Jesus taught, he would have listened. And he would have learned, and he would have accepted those truths, and they would have changed his life. If Jesus hasn't changed your life, then you may be more like Annas than you should be. If you have a need to respond to the invitation, if you need to allow Jesus' teachings to have a bigger impact on your life, to change who you are, to be more like who He is, you have a need to respond to become a Christian because you've never become one, you can do that as well. You can repent of your sins, and based on your belief in Jesus as the Son of God, you can confess that fact and then be buried with Him in baptism to wash your sins away. If you have a need to respond to God's invitation for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.